Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be doing something very new for Writers on Film. First time I've ever done this. I'm going to be talking to three different authors at the same time. They are part of the We Are the Mutants website, which is a fascinating website which deals in sort of 60s, post-60s cultural history and looks at lots of things. Music, books, culture generally, politics, the whole underground culture, the counterculture, looks at all these things. And they've written a book, and the book is called We Are the Mutants, The Battle for Hollywood from Rosemary's Baby to Lethal Weapon. They are Kelly Roberts, Michael Grasso, and Richard McKenna. And we talked about their book. What they do in the book, which is really fascinating, is they put two films together. They sort of bang them together and see what happens. And some of the pairings are absolutely, all of the pairings are fascinating. All of them are kind of surprising, and all of them bring out stuff which is really, really... Anyway, enough from me. This is a great conversation. You'll enjoy it. The best argument for it is the conversation itself. So without further ado, if you enjoy the episode, please remember to like, subscribe, spread the word as wide as you can. We're getting loads of listeners and we hope to get loads more with your help. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, D-R-J-O-N-T-Y. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Absolutely in my wheelhouse of interests, I guess. And from the cover, I just thought this is amazing, which I will describe to the listeners, even though I'll put a image up on the podcast. But it's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Apocalypse Now, Star Wars. I think that's Night of the Living Dead. In the back, is that Night of the Living Dead? The sort of silhouetted figures.
I think we were just shooting for like a suburban family that was doomed, but it could easily also be zombies.
Right. Yep. Okay.
Plus the shadowy figure illuminated by light, very reminiscent of The Exorcist's famous movie poster as well. So.
Yeah,
it's meant to be more of a collage of aspects of the films that we talk.
Right. Okay. Brilliant. Brilliant. So let me first ask you, if you like, actually, I think the best thing to do would be for you to sort of, we'll go around and individually identify yourself and say, maybe how you came towards writing about film and how you came to sort of join this collective that you have together. Michael, if you want to go first.
Oh, well, thanks, John. I'm Mike Grasso. I am a senior editor at We Are the Mutants. Richard and I have a kind of a similar history when it comes to how all three of us got together, which is, I think basically Richard and I wrote Kelly fan mail back in, oh gosh, probably 2014, something like that. Just saying how much we really loved his site, Two Warps to Neptune. And from that sort of gushing fan mail, We Are the Mutants was born a little less than a year later, if my memory is correct, Kelly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, they both sort of contacted me separately. And then Richard actually ended up writing some stuff for Two Warps to Neptune. And I thought this, you know, this collaborative aspect interested me, right? It was just me sort of writing this blog, and suddenly, you know, others are sort of interested in the same thing. So that's how We Are the Mutants came about. I mean, once Mike and Richard said, you know, they were into it, that was it. I mean, it took us, I think, about 6 months to come up with some articles that we could run and sort of fix up the site. But that's how it got started.
No, I'll just say that my big mistake was the same as Mike's. I sent Kelly an email saying I liked his site and then ended up getting drawn into the nightmare that ensued.
I mean, it's interesting actually reading the book and having this idea of like a collective, critical collective. I mean, because it sort of feels to me a little bit like how things were in the 60s and 70s. It sort of seems like an idea from the very period that you're interested in.
Well, that's super interesting. I've never even sort of thought of it like that. But yeah, that's where the sort of network comes from, right? Silicon Valley, University of Berkeley. I was just surprised that, you know, they both liked me. I don't think it was
I don't
like
think I've ever said that, Kelly. Did I ever actually said that?
Or put up with me, I should say. But yeah, that's really interesting. And because we've been sort of writing together for so long, you know, six plus years, you know, we told Joe Banks at The Quietus, it's, you know, we sort of came up with this unified theory. We were both just sort of, all three of us would riff on one another. And, you know, often when we're writing a piece, our research material is just something the other one has written for the site, you know. So we're generally, we go pretty deep when we research a piece. So, you know, we're all on the same wavelength. And I think film is probably our favorite media. If we had to choose, and that's sort of how this book came about. I mean, the original pitch was not necessarily film. We wanted to do essays about all different sort of media subculture. You know, an essay about hitchhiking in the 60s and 70s and why it was important, and disco and punk. But it turned out it just wasn't. It wasn't in terms of sales, not something publisher was looking for. So we just sort of flipped it and thought it would be interesting to do a book on film, and each of us sort of picked the films we wanted to write about and riff on each other like throughout the book.
And so you had this idea that this sort of thesis, as you say, that goes through the book, and the practice that you the way you express this idea is by putting two not necessarily obvious films together and kind of bouncing them off each other to see, you know, it's like theoretical physics. You're sort of shooting the Large Hadron Collider. You're sort of sending two films around and seeing what happens when they crash in the middle. How did you divvy those up, and did you sit down and have a group discussion and say, or did you just come up with pitches for each other and then sort of do it that way?
As I remember, the pairings kind of came naturally, more or less. As you say, a lot of them don't seem very obvious on the surface, but I think once we decided we were going to do this whole idea of, like, as you say, kind of having two movies kind of scrape up against each other and see what kind of friction results, I think it became obvious for a lot of us. I mean, we also have a lot of lost chapters that didn't make it into the book, a lot of lost pairings that, you know, one of the ones I wanted to do was Blue Velvet and Back to the Future. And when I did a little bit of Googling, I found out there are many, many essays out there comparing those two films, all of which were very good, but I did not want to retread any ground that was apparently obvious to a whole bunch of other people out there.
And I think as well. Oh, sorry.
No, no. Go ahead. Go ahead, Richard.
No, I think. I mean, we'd spent. Film is maybe one of the things we've spent less time on the actual website in terms of the articles we put up. But we've always spoken a lot about films when we're chatting. You know, just amongst ourselves. So a lot. We've kind of built up, I think, a huge amount of interest in or films that interested us, and the ideas about them that had never really found a way into the site. And the book kind of provided a bit of an ideal pretext for putting those together and looking. I mean, like I say, Mike said, there were a lot of pairings that didn't make it. Some particularly atrocious ones on my part, but which is probably not a bad thing. They didn't make it, but we had.
That was the hardest thing, I think, was whittling down, you know, these pairings. I think originally the idea was we were going to have like 7 or 8 pairings for each section. Mm. And I think, you know, we ended up with 4 with 4 for each section, which I, you know, I think 7 would have been too much. But yeah, there were a lot of, we could do another book, you know, with the pairings that we had to sacrifice.
Oh, well, please do. I mean, that's, I'm ashamed to say, Mike, that when you said Blue Velvet and Back to the Future, I thought that's never been done. Immediately, I thought that's go for it. I want to read that. Now you tell me,
John, do you know that that's exactly what I shouted when I found, like, again, multiple blog posts of people who, and again, they were all really, really great, and they were going to hit the same area I was going to hit, which is that, you know, 1950s America was very incestuous. Back to the Future and Blue Velvet have very, very similar themes as far as that's concerned. Like, it was. It, you know, but it's, you know, again, I think that kind of led as a springboard to us kind of splitting these movies up into 3 periods as well, because I think it's very clear that the movies we chose for the 80s differ really, really seriously from the ones that came out during that, again, sort of like, you know, studio rebels, quote unquote, period of Hollywood that we try to, you know, kind of cut down to size in the book. But you know, it became clear to us that the themes that these directors were exploring and screenwriters changed a lot over the 20 or so years that we look at in the book.
And I think another thing that I noticed, I'm not sure I was aware of it while we were doing it or even while we were writing the stuff on the website, but was the a sort of irritation with the sort of dominant narrative about you know, the sort of Raging Bulls thing and stuff, and just the way people speak about direct. I don't know. I think all 3 of us share a little bit of kind of gets on our nerves a bit when there's this very pat narrative that gets trotted out, and leather jackets and people throwing over desks and smoking cigars. Just kind of, because it just seemed like there was a much bigger world of things going on, and you know, and it's like the sort of survival thing, isn't it? You see the ones that made it big and everyone knows, whereas a lot of the other stuff which may have been just as interesting often ends up being quite marginalized or just disappearing, you know.
You know, and the other factor is we wanted to make sure that all the films we chose were genre of some kind or another. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, maybe it's a little, you know, loose to throw documentaries as a genre. I cover, you know, one mockumentary, one documentary in my chapters, but we just wanted to make sure it was from those, you know, some of these films got critical and commercial success, you know, a lot of them didn't. And we wanted to kind of, you know, be a little bit ecumenical about what we accepted into sort of the idea of genre film. You know, we've got police films, we've got thrillers, but we've also got sci-fi, horror, you know, all that stuff as well.
I think if a handful of people watch Parting Glances and Suburbia and Seconds, then, you know, we're all happy, because those are all incredible films that I think deserve a wider audience. So that was another thing that was fun about writing a book, was, you know, we got to write about films that we really admire and like and think deserve a wider showing. So, you know, I've already had like a couple emails where, you know, readers are saying, you know, I just watched Suburbia, or I just watched Parting Glances, you know, thank you for that. And that's really all I wanted.
That's all I want in life. Someone to follow me on Letterboxd.
Someone validate my selections of films.
The kids have to be made aware of Phase 4. You know, it's like it definitely that kind of vibe to it.
That's right. The ants will kill you. You never know.
Man, that's I was reading Quentin Tarantino's Cinema Speculation over the holidays, and the thing that I find funny, it goes back to what Richard was saying about the Peter Biskin sort of narrative of Easy Riders and Raging Bulls, is that he sort of has this mantle as the sort of ultimate genre guy, and then he sort of starts ripping into something stuff like Towering Inferno and saying, oh, that was, you know, this piece of... I watched Towering Inferno the other day and I was like, okay, it is what it is. I'm not making any great claims for it, but as a piece of genre cinema, it really works, you know. It's really good. It's
I
really...
don't want to hear anybody knocking Irwin Allen ever. Right.
Yeah,
and I noticed that you're a bit of a Killdozer fan there as well, John. So I know. So we've got that. Yeah. Don't knock Irwin Allen. Leave
how
Irwin
many
alone.
Must die?
Yeah. The finale with the water is quite good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very, very well done.
Yeah. Honestly, that might be one of the genres we didn't get a chance to really dive into in the book. Is we've talked about it on the website quite a bit. The 70s disaster film. You know, again, there's a lot of obvious things you can say about that genre as a manifestation of American anxiety in the 70s. But they're also just really, I mean, again, they're just sort of the broadest sort of appeal. You've got these guest stars from the golden age of Hollywood that all the old folks in the audience will be able to recognize, and some folks from TV. And like, you know, basically, there's a reason why they copycatted Airport. They copycatted all these other films is because people went to go see them. They were just as huge as The Exorcist, you know?
Absolutely.
I suppose they also tended to be really good receptacles for just dumping in loads of the hot topic issues like earthquake and stuff. There's always like, it's like 10 of the things that people get pissed off about them and throw them in as well as an earthquake, and that'll be the best film ever. And it sort of is the best film ever. So
I thought it was funny about in the end of Towering Inferno, Steve McQueen says to Paul Newman, the next time one of you guys wants to build one of these, why don't you ask us about it? He's like, yeah, maybe I will. I'll see you tomorrow morning. And it's just like, I've got a feeling firemen were consulted about, you know, building shit before.
What has this country forgotten about sensible city planning? And that's like the lesson of the film, right?
But it is funny that there are, you know, so many of them are so firmly sort of anti-corporate and anti-capitalistic. I mean, we talk about that on the site as well, that the politics are usually pretty progressive.
Yeah, they're kind of all over the place. I mean, O.J. Simpson, yeah. I mean, forget who O.J. Simpson is for 5 seconds, but, you know, he plays a major sort of active black character in the film, and there's no mention of his race throughout. There's not, it's like a non-issue, you know, which for the 1970s is in itself progressive. Let's talk about films that you actually do cover in the book, because thank you for the link. You sent me a link to the website for the disaster movie, so if you do go to the website, you'll be able to read up on that as well, dear listener. So you start in the late 60s at the sort of properly the inception of what is going to be described as New Hollywood, with Rosemary's Baby and Martin Scorsese's Bloody Mama as your first pairing. And then you do Peter Watkins' Punishment Park, Wild in the Streets, Seconds, Watermelon Man, and The Exorcist, Manson. Those are the pairings as you go through. Let's start with Rosemary's Baby, Bloody Mama. That right there is getting off to the races.
Yeah, it took me a while to come up with a good one to go with Rosemary's Baby. I had written a bit about the novel Rosemary's Baby on the site. The movie's quite different. A lot of the sort of political, social issues are taken out of the movie. Probably because, you know, Roman Polanski was not American and didn't have a great understanding of those issues. But they still sort of come through in the film. And I think the reason I start with Rosemary's Baby is because, you know, it really is that the most apocalyptic point in American history, where you've got Vietnam, you know, the assassination of MLK, Robert Kennedy. And there's just this sense that everything is falling apart. And of course, you know, Rosemary's Baby, here's poor Mia Farrow, who's about to give, who does give birth to the Antichrist. But also there's, I think, you know, we sort of see Rosemary as this feminist character, which is interesting, because at the very end, you know, she has to decide what she's going to do. And in the book, she actually thinks about grabbing the kid and jumping out of the window, killing them both. But in the movie, you know, after a little bit of screaming, you know, she accepts the child and sort of the life and the Antichrist that's been born. So I'm not sure that's exactly feminism. But I do, you know, and of course, Roger Corman.
It's not exactly feminism. Nurturing the Antichrist isn't exactly feminism, I guess.
Well, you know, she chooses the, you know, I think the movie is, you know, she's all about this suburban, you know, everything she wants is, she wants the husband, she wants the, you know, three kids, 2 years apart. And she sort of unweaves this incredible conspiracy, right, against not only her, but the world. So the end, that's why the end is so shocking, right? That she sort of makes the decision that she makes. And Bloody, you know, Bloody Mama is Roger Corman film, that I really like. And Shelley Winters is sort of devastating and over the top. And it's a, you know, it's a ripoff of Bonnie and Clyde, which of course made, was one of the quintessential new Hollywood films, and a film I really do like. I think it's just an incredible film. It's one of those that sort of deserves the status that it's achieved, in my opinion. I just thought sort of focusing on these two female characters was an interesting place to start. And they're both sort of, the end of Bloody Mama is just as apocalyptic. There's a huge shootout, you know, everybody dies. And, you know, America sort of obsession with violence and spectacle really comes out at the end of that film. I think we usually think, you know, we think of Roger Corman as this, you know, king of the bees, he's called, but he really did direct and produce some thought provoking films. And, you know, as a filmmaker, he does, I don't think he gets the respect that he deserves. I mean, without him, there's no Easy Rider. You know, he gave so many people that we recognize as new Hollywood their start. And, you know, a lot of them will talk about that. Jack Nicholson has talked about him quite extensively, for instance. I think just sort of put Polanski and Corman together in one essay was fun, was pretty fun for me to do. Although I think that one also took me the longest to write, just because I had to figure out how to get them both together.
Yeah, it's kind of, I always think as well of Polanski as the beginning of that sort of, I was talking to Adam Neyman about a year ago, and he came up with this phrase that I've stolen ever since, the gentrification of genre, sort of taking...
Oh, God, Damon, that's been driving me mad for years.
Just that idea that he takes a potboiler sort of novel and turns it into something which is very sort of, which if it was released today, we would call elevated horror, because we would be that, you know, it would have that cachet that something like, say, Texas Chainsaw Massacre never had. You know, Texas Chainsaw would be my counter argument for gentrification. That's kind of like, you know, you found it in a jumble sale horror. That's
Night of the Living Dead too, right? Which came out the same year as Rosemary's Baby would not get the same respect that Rosemary's Baby got.
Exactly. Or I mean, even The Exorcist, there's a sense of like that these are important films. Yes, they're shocking. Yes, they're part of a big intellectual conversation rather than, I know Mark Kermode for one goes on about how, you know, Exorcist isn't respected as much as it should be, but I think it's kind of respected far more than, not far more than it should be, but, you know, it's kind of funny.
Yeah,
that
it gets plenty of respect.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's maybe at the expense of some better films, perhaps. I don't know. But Who knows? Sorry, I'm not going to go into that. Punishment Park, Michael. You went for that. The Pete Watkins controversial sort of mockumentary, I guess you'd say.
I mean, I was reading. You know, again, we went through a lot of contemporary reviews of these films because we want to land all of these films in their context, socially, politically, you know, mass psychologically, whatever. And yeah, I mean, you know, every time that generations would get together in, you know, student-run film centers or whatever, and watch Watkins's Punishment Park, I mean, there would be real like recapitulation of the anger on the screen, the generation gap between, you know, these folks who are throwing these young political prisoners into a survival park in the desert. That resemble nothing less than a U.S. draft board at the time. You know, these are the kinds of things that draft boards were doing to determine who would go and fight over Vietnam. And Watkins just projects that ahead, you know, only a couple of years to look at what America might look like if, you know, there was mass detention of young political activists. And when people would watch this film in real life, there would be really, really just hard-edged arguments between the generations about, you know, the kids saw themselves on the screen. They said, that's us in 2 years. And the parents' generation were like, what do you take us for, fascists? And, you know, the answer is right there in the question. You know, it's a rough film to watch over and over again, I'll tell you that much. And I paired it with Wild in the Streets because they both have this undercurrent of detention camps. In Wild in the Streets, it's goofy, right? It's like, we're going to throw all the adults into a LSD camp and teach them how to be loving and peaceful. But that was in the air, wasn't it, at this time? It was the idea that if there was a mass revolution or a mass revolutionary movement in America, that we had the detention camps ready for them. You know, Nixon and Governor Reagan both, you know, had secret plans to detain, much as we did during World War II, Japanese and some German and Italian Americans, young people who were against the war. So to pair a goofy satire with a really hard-edged and really hard to watch satire, I mean, you know, it created, I think, a chapter that I think for me kind of helped crystallize what the movement was all about. By 1970, 1971, when Punishment Park came out, you know, the kids at Kent State had lost their lives, you know, kids at other schools had lost their lives to U.S. soldiers bringing the war home. And at that point, you either had to go underground or you had to go, you know, back and get recuperated into the mainstream, which is what happened to a lot of those activists, unfortunately. But a good pair of movies. Like I said, it was rough to watch Punishment Park over and over again, but I really, really enjoyed how well it kind of rubbed against Wild in the Streets.
Absolutely. And I mean, the thing you've got to about Kent State, you know, the shooting that took place there, where unarmed demonstrators were shot by the National Guard, murdered essentially, was that when they did opinion polls a week later, majority of the US population, according to the polls, supported the military action. This, you know, there wasn't an upsurge of anger or, you know, in the Nixonian sort of silent majority, if you like.
Exactly.
I mean, could it be that there's a sort of almost like a demonic reflection of the hippie commune in these, you know, you're gaining a sort of, you have this utopian idea of a small society, a sort of, and then the Opticon sort of prison idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's coming from John Stuart Mill, isn't it? It's coming as well from sort of like a utopian, essentially.
You know, I made the note in the Punishment Park chapter that Watkins picked the desert for a few reasons. One is that it does speak of America and sort of that, you know, frontier that has now disappeared. And it's the same landscape that they would shoot, you know, cowboy movies on. But who else hung out at a cowboy movie ranch? Charles Manson and the family. I mean, the idea that these kids are now being thrown into a dystopian, you know, situation in the desert, I think it calls up all of these different images that people had seen over the past 3 years when this movie came out. And that includes the Manson family. And that includes sort of the idea that, you know, horrible stuff is happening out there in the desert, whether it's the invention of a nuclear bomb or people being detained in, you know, mass detention camps, or, you know, the young people plotting and planning revolution, whatever form that takes. Watkins didn't choose to put it in a heavily wooded area in the Northwest or something like that. He picked the desert. And I think for a lot of reasons that rang true and sort of felt very American, you know, very quintessentially American.
I was going to say it's a kind of unique. I mean, we I think we have one in Spain, but in Europe, the other than that one in Spain, which Sergio Leone made such great use of, that's the only desert in Europe. You know, so if you're talking about the West, you're talking about Australia and America and the United States as being the two countries which sort of have, you know, have deserts as part of their landmass. I really want to come over to Richard as well in a second, but before I do, we have to talk a little bit about Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because it's here I agree with Tarantino. He calls it a perfect movie, and I utterly agree with him about this. Your sort of argument with first of all, it's really interesting generically that you're pairing it with a documentary.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't believe that no one had written about those two films before. I'm still not convinced that there's not a piece or a book out there somewhere that compares them, because I think they're just a perfect match. I think initially I tried to get Mike to write it because I was a little afraid to do it, and Mike was like, nope. This one's all you. and it turned out to be, I think, of the chapters I've written, my favorite. Just
I'm very glad you wrote it, Kelly. You did a better job than I ever could have. So,
I mean, Mike was talking about how hard it was to watch Punishment Park over and over again. I mean, I must have watched Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, 10 times in a week, because that, you know, I had a week to write that chapter, and just the screaming and the chainsaw. My God, I thought I was going insane.
See, it's funny. Of those two movies, I would have found Harlan County, USA the tougher one to watch over and over again. I mean, yeah, I know there's a lot of hope in it, but it doesn't, you know, it's just such a grim, you know, sort of situation to watch over and over.
And that's the reality we're talking about, right? That grim reality of the 70s where, you know, unions were already sort of on the decline. The manufacturing sector was, you know, being destroyed, and everything sort of being shipped overseas. So I really, you know, I just really, you know, when you look at Harlan County, USA, there's no, one of the first things I noticed is there's no counterculture in Harlan County, USA. Mm. They don't have the luxury or the privilege of a counterculture, because they're just working to pay the rent and to pay for food. And so I thought, you know, and then you look at Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is about basically these hippies, and it's like they're coming into Harlan County, you know, and the quality of Harlan County, which they don't understand at all. You know, and they pay for it. It's just really, I thought it was a really interesting comparison. A recurring theme for me throughout is sort of narcissism of the counterculture. I don't know if at times I could try to be fair, but also one of the points I wanted to make was that, you know, they really were born of this privilege and this post-war boom that had never been seen before in America, and I don't think has been seen since. And without sort of that privilege, you know, we wouldn't have had the movies like Easy Rider and Bonnie and Clyde, because people had to go see those movies. They had to pay to go see those movies. They went to film school, and they paid to go to film school, and that's how they saw some of these movies. So New Hollywood really rests on that audience, that counterculture audience.
Oh, it's a disposable income, and it's the newly made leisure. They're not having to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and go to work, and, you know,
exactly.
I mean, that's what I always think about. At the moment, the British Prime Minister is talking about making maths compulsory until you're 18.
Oh, fuck.
Sorry, Richard, I'm depressing you with that. But the thing is, if you look at the 60s, the creative explosion in Britain in the 60s was art colleges, because everyone who went to art college became a millionaire. You know, I mean, you had Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, the entirety of Pink Floyd.
Pink Floyd, yeah.
You know, all these all these artists, not just artists, but all these musicians, all these writers, were all fostered by art colleges, which you would think economically would be negligible, but the amount of tax those guys poured back into the exchequer paid for the whole system. You know, you only need 10 of them and you've paid for the whole system for everybody. Richard, I was promising to, because I think this goes in very well with Silent Running, which is a film that you really interestingly sort of take to task in terms of that that sort of counterculture and that sort of eco idea that I'm very sympathetic with to some degree, but in the film you kind of, well, I don't want to put your argument, you give me your argument.
I think my main, the problem I had with it started from the fact that I sort of felt betrayed, having not seen it for years. And you know, it's a film I grew up loving, really love it, just very intensely. And I hadn't watched it for years. I watched it again, and I just, the reaction I got was just I don't know, violent, really angry and pissed off. And I couldn't work out why. So I think a lot of the writing, the chapter was sort of partly that, trying to work out why it was pissing me off so much. And I think it was that, gradually realizing that it was not what it, in some ways, what it was claiming to be as a film. It was still macho frontiersmanship. It was still solipsistic. It was still somebody, you know, these people are pissing me off, I'm going to kill them. And because that was being sold to you with these just absolutely adorable droids that still do my head in, I still love those droids. And, you know, with an immensely engaging and sympathetic main character, I kind of fell into that as like, how can this film be wrong? This film is absolutely 100% right. And I think that was the way the film worked. And seeing it again, you know, after, you know, spending a lot of time talking to Mike and Kelly and, you know, for years of us chatting about these kind of things, just an undertone in there that just really rang false to me, and it really stood out to me now. And I think that was the reason I was so sort of, you know, angry about it, was because I did feel a bit betrayed by this film that I'd just seen as an act, one of the few acts of kind of, you know, purity. And it just didn't feel like that as an adult. It felt very much like, you know, that was maybe how it originally been intended, but, you know, that was not the way it had ended up being, basically. It kind of left a bit of a weird taste in my mouth.
Kelly.
I was just going to say, I think that's my favorite of Richard's chapters. Also, Silent Running did not piss him off as much as Poltergeist. I don't know if we'll get to Poltergeist, but Silent Running, I still enjoy watching that movie, but you really sort of pull from it something that I didn't recognize. Like, what? And I've seen it, I don't know, probably eight or nine times. And it's this idea that, you know, his claim to care for the world and care for the planet and care for the animals is really just him wanting those things for himself.
Yeah. Right.
It's not really saving them. It's just wanting them for himself. So really, he's just this selfish individual who's blowing everybody up for his own.
He doesn't seem that different from the rest of the people. Yeah, like, he doesn't sort of calmly try and talk his colleagues into this thing. He just gets fucked off as soon as he sees them. You know, which, you're not really solving the problem there, are you? You're not explaining to them. You're just shouting at them. You know, and anyone can shout at people. That doesn't make you the good guy.
And in so many ways, Phase 4 is the more honest ecological movie, because it says that you are messing around with nature. Nature will mess right around back with you, and it will adjust the ways that it messes back around with you until you're subsumed into it again. And, like, you know, there were a lot of ecological message movies that were fatalistic in the 70s, you know, Soylent Green, whatever, sort of mainstream ones, little scene ones. But I think that's the reason why Phase 4 hits so well as the counterpoint to Silent Running. It's like, nature is implacable. Like, you know, in the end, all of these jetliners with these huge domes on them in Silent Running, I mean, like, we're losing them all. And even if they haven't been lost, they've been taken off of the planet and separated from the planet that they need to be on. Mm. I mean, Phase 4 is definitely more, like, brutally direct about what it's trying to say, which is that they're going to come back around and eat you. You know what I mean? They're going to come back around.
And we'll deserve it. and will deserve
exactly.
it.
You know, I'm not even sure it's that. I think it's like Mike says, it's sort of the fact that phase four decenters humans. Silent Running is all about humans. Humans are going to do it. Humans are going to save it. A man is going to save nature. Phase four is like humans are no longer the center.
Something and if anything, else. the ecology in the 70s was all about what we can do to fix things.
Yeah, yeah.
And in a lot of ways, you know,
face always like nature's going to fix you.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the concept of nature in Silent Running is like, you know, something kept under glass, like in a museum exhibit. It's a diorama. It's not.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not what nature is. That's not an ecosystem, even. You know, it's
exactly. Yeah. Like as I said, the thing it's kind of sort of an exhibit in a mall.
Yeah.
You know, this perfect glossy green. Yeah. Cheese plants, you know, it's a bit like what I used to see at the Arndale Centre in Doncaster in the 70s. Oh, those are nice.
The Arndale Centre.
That was a hell of a shopping centre.
Oh. I've been there many a time. God, talking about nightmares. And then you've got like, the one thing that I think is interesting about Richard's reaction to Silent Running and it very much, I kind of was rediscovering the film through his chapter and it was making me go, oh yeah, hang on a minute. Is that these films to some degree kind of very persuasively give you a universe in which the people who are at the center are kind of right. You know, that this decision is right. I always found that in terms of The Exorcist, what was so scary about The Exorcist was it posited a universe in which the good guys were the Catholic Church. And you know, it's just like, shit, really? I mean, I was brought up by these bastards, you know?
So, yeah, totally.
So, and you don't go to the movie thinking this is going to tell me it's a horror film. It's not going to be this is the Catholic Church are right, but it's no, that's everything is wrong with the modern world. And the only Max von Sydow turns up and sorts it all out, you know. And he was only like in his 20s or something. No, I'm joking. He wasn't in his 20s, but he wasn't that old. He seems like ancient in that movie. So who did The Exorcist? Michael, you did The Exorcist, right?
Yeah, I paired it with the 1973 documentary Manson. They came out at opposite end of the year, but I couldn't. Again, like I really, as grotty as that Manson documentary is, I really love it because it's obviously exploitation, right? It's obviously meant to capitalize on interest in the family, who by 72 and 73 were a little long in the tooth. A lot of them had fallen away from the sort of like, you know, adhering to Charlie's teachings. Obviously, Squeaky Fromm in a few years is going to take a pot shot at President Ford, but that's in the future at this point. They're still sort of like, they're in like survivalist mode, basically. They're out in the wilderness. They've got their rifles. And this documentary is done about the killings, the trial, and really tries to make the Manson family into these misunderstood hippies. You know what I mean? And done through this idea that Manson did something to the girls, to whether he used the sort of 1950s patriarchal programming that was already abroad in the sort of society, whether he used some Dale Carnegie or L. Ron Hubbard style mind control tricks to keep them, you know, drugs, whatever. But that movie is really about how scary it is when girls decide what they want to do for themselves. And I found that that was a great pairing with The Exorcist, which to me isn't really a story of the Catholic Church coming to save the day. It's the story of a mother and daughter who according to William Blatty and Friedkin, cannot survive in the world without a man in their life. So both these movies are really these messages of like, men saying that girls need a daddy, and that I chose for the title of the chapter. Every girl needs a daddy, which the unspoken part of that is from the Manson documentary, just like Charlie. So whether the Abrahamic God is the same as Charles Manson, I try to prove that in my chapter, that all these structures of religion, patriarchy, politically, you know, Manson recapitulates them just the same way as Captain Howdy or.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times.
underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The God that Karras and the Catholic Church follow. It's a missing father, and nothing made American men more anxious in the early 70s than a family without a father. I mean, nothing's changed, obviously. We're in 2023, exactly 50 years later, and the same religious, you know, patriarchal type folks are saying the same exact thing. We need the nuclear family. We need this and that. When in fact, it was the nuclear family that created all this psychic stress amongst the daughters of the 1950s American family.
Rosemary was also separated from her father, I should say. So it's a lot of similarities between those two movies as well.
Oh, yeah.
And again, going back to Rosemary's Baby, there's this idea of the cult and everything. But she's raped by her own husband while she's asleep. Yeah. And the thing that's scary about that today is she doesn't even seem to know that she's been raped in the,
And in America, that was not a crime in most states in 1968. I mean, that would have been something that
It's really a horrifying reality. It didn't become illegal in all 50 states until the 90s. So there's that really, there's that really uncomfortable scene in the movie where, she says, "What do you mean I was asleep and you still did it?" And he said, "Yeah, it was baby night." And she sort of turns her back to the camera. She's just so incredibly vulnerable and sick about it.
He makes some joke about it with being like necrophilia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jesus.
So, yeah, it's just in fact, she was raped by a monster either way, right? If it's Guy, he's this horrible person, but in fact, it was the devil instead.
Yeah.
Who Guy has sold his soul to become a star, to become a film star,
Has he sold his soul, or has he just sold her?
Well, yeah. Sorry. He has, wouldn't you say, sold his sort of wife, and he's got to become part of the coven. It's basically it's a Faust. It's a Faustian deal, right? He's made a deal with the devil.
Sure, absolutely.
And I think it's interesting, of course, that
he's also a male figure in the film.
Super male,
That Regan's mother is a film actress as well. It's very heavily implied that her career got in the way of the marriage, and that's why the husband is estranged and/or divorced right now. Though obviously, like, Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist go together, like, they're beautiful together. But I think that, like, when I rewatched The Exorcist for the book, I found the first third of the movie before the possession so much more interesting than the rest of the film, because it was just like, how do you deal with being a family of two when you've been used to being this like nuclear family of three for so long? And I noticed this, when I watched it, is like the moment that Regan starts to change is when she hears her mother swearing on the phone to her father, like just really just letting loose all of her anger, her righteous anger about what's happened to this marriage and to this family. And it's the very next day that like all of her strange behavior starts. And so, my idea is that this demon did not come from Iraq. It didn't come from a Ouija board. It came from this family splitting up. And again, like that anxiety for true dyed-in-the-wool patriarchs that love the Catholic Church is going to be, it's going to just provoke nothing but fear. So.
Absolutely.
I think John's right. This is a defense of Catholicism. I mean, from the first frame through the very last, it's and that's how Blatty wrote it. I mean, it's definitely a defensive.
The gay director gets sort of offed in a sort
tossed out of the window, or
I mean, it's a film that I've rewatched many times, and it's but I think that's what's great about all of these essays is every as familiar as I am with many of these movies. Each essay made me go, not only that's surprising, but the surprise wasn't like a reach. You know what I mean? Sometimes when you read some criticism, you can go, oh, okay, I kind of get you. I mean, Tarantino's cinema speculations do involve a lot of like, maybe if, and if this was this, if that was that, and okay. But your analysis was that really... threading that needle of being both original but sort of obvious. Do you know what I mean? In the way that I was totally surprised by it, but it had the power of the, oh yeah, of course, you know. I mean, I'm specific.
Thank you, John. That's that's very flattering.
I think I had that moment with every single chapter, the ones I wrote, the ones these guys wrote. Like I was like, oh, right, yeah. And again, like I had to watch a lot of the films, especially the 80s ones, to kind of get a sense of what these guys were talking about in the 80s chapters and stuff. And like, I was like, oh yeah, wow, this is a perfect pairing. And it's saying this about that and that about this. Yeah. I mean, the only thing that's been more interesting sort of just like than putting together my own chapter was reading these guys' chapters when they went through the editing process.
Right. Right. And did you, I mean, one of the things that I think sort of goes, maybe one of the reasons I'm having this reaction and this book is so fruitful and interesting is that these films are really, really good at being very ideological and at the same time hiding that ideology, so that it's very seductive. You're just drawn in and you're totally engaged in the film, and it's almost like an invitation not to think, really, while at the same time being totally, you know, elbows deep in the problems and the issues of the day.
Oh, hang on. Yeah. Sorry.
I think that's been part of the, I mean, that's something we've worked out by, I think, writing for the site. And I don't, again, it's just sort of this, all of us coming together and, you know, bouncing things off one another. And I don't know that it's a new way of doing things, but it's certainly something that felt new to me, right? We have a particular way of analyzing, I think, different media. Mm-hmm. And we're always looking for, you know, what does it say about historically what's going on? What does it say about, like, what's being repressed? What does it say about... you know, gender or race or we try to sort of take everything in and write about it in a way that's not sort of academic. It doesn't use that sort of jargon, which is hard sometimes because, you know, most of the stuff that's been written comes from that academic field when you're looking at film studies and film criticism and things like that. So I think at the very least, that's something that I'm proud of. I think all of us, you know, it meant a lot to us to write a book that sort of you don't need a PhD to understand it. I mean, it does go sort of deep into the times and sort of history, but I think if you're willing to sort of engage with that and that's your something you enjoy, I think it's accessible for everyone. But yeah, sorry, go ahead, John.
No, absolutely. I was just going to double down on that. I actually think the way you bring back the real world into these films and how they're engaging with things that maybe people have forgotten about or maybe people just didn't know, you know, that brings these films alive in totally different ways and totally, you know, and the fact that somebody would be going to see Death Wish and Escape from New York the same, you know, in the same year, in the same cinema, or maybe, you know, the same date night or whatever, and reading the newspapers and watching the news before they went to see it and listening to a record before on the radio as they, you know, drove to the cinema. These you know, it kind of recreates a really, it brings it back to life, I think, and gets away from this deification of the sort of nostalgia of the 70s and 80s, which yeah, isn't conducive to good discussion.
No, thank you, Joe. That's very good to hear, man. That's what we were aiming for, I think.
I mean, I think you bring up the audience, John, you know, seeing Death Wish, Escape from New York, seeing all these movies. I think that's something a lot of people forget, that if you don't have that Hollywood's always just going to be about making money. And then if your movie's doesn't have an audience, it's probably not going to get made. So there was an audience for a particular kind of film in the 70s, and Reagan was elected, right? People's ideas were changing. There was a new audience in the 80s, right? I mean, it's not, you know, and you say, oh, well, you know, the 80s totally sold out and all these awful movies, and the 70s was this golden age. There were plenty of incredible movies in the 80s. And I'm not talking about Back to the Future. I'm talking about, like, you know, the Coen brothers started in the 80s. Jim Jarmusch started in the 80s. Yeah. You know, Spike Lee and a lot of Black filmmakers were able to make movies in the 80s. So it's a disingenuous argument.
I think one of the things that Kelly's introduction does really well is trace what the movie business was going through at the time. And again, something very fundamental did change right in that period where Jaws and Star Wars came out. And it wasn't just about tastes in the audience. It was about actual physical brick and mortar, like, cinemas. And, you know, where were you watching your film? Was it in a one screen movie house in a small town? Or was it in a 16 screen movie factory that could, you know, service all of these people buying tickets at once? And the era of the blockbuster that kind of came in with Spielberg and Lucas, it changed the business. And, you know, we, again, Kelly talks about it. Lucas made a Vietnam parable where we were asked to identify with the Viet Cong and sort of underdogs throughout history. But by 1983, and by the time the Return of the Jedi came into the film, I mean, the messages in film were overtly patriotic, right? They were basically saying, you know, Vietnam didn't happen. Here we are now. We're cleansed of that sin. And, you know, like, we find a lot of interesting stuff in those mainstream movies in the 80s in this book as well. But as Kelly said, like, the important stuff was happening on the margins in the 80s. And it had something to say about this Reagan revolution that Kelly mentioned.
I should also mention that a lot more women got the chance to make films in the 80s. I talk about that in the introduction as well. It's important as well.
It's still a relatively tiny number, unfortunately, but...
Yeah, I mean, it has to also be said that it was difficult to be a woman in the films of the 70s. I mean, if you were a woman in the films of the 70s, you got raped. I mean, there was just no two ways about it, you know. And as part of the, you know, I mean, have you one film I watched recently for the first time was Looking for Mr. Goodbar. That's such a rough, I mean, it's, I'm so undecided on that film because it's so, but I'd like to read an essay by one of you guys, about that film paired with, I don't know, Straw Dogs or something as a way of,
cruising.
You know, I was going to say Cruising. Yeah. Richard, where is the danger located when you are talking about sexual liberation between heterosexual women and homosexual men? And it's like, yeah, I mean, it, you know, you can be an undercover cop like Al Pacino and go undercover and, you know, defend yourself from a serial killer. But again, like, that's what those movies are about. It's like, what is the price that we pay for this sense of liberation? How far can you take it? You know, and, you know, again, like, a lot of these messages end up being very sort of, you know, retrograde. Who deserves, you know, to be murdered, raped, whatever. I get into it in the Exorcist chapter. It's really, really hard. Like I said, when you've seen contemporary feminist critics were all over this when they saw The Exorcist, they're like, this is a pornographic movie. Like, this is a fantasy about what happens to a little girl, and it's a fantasy written by men. And I think that you're right. I think women characters, with a very few exceptions in the 70s, really are asked to either be you know, the adoring helpmate of the, you know, like Badlands, you know, like, or, you know, somebody like Ridley Scott comes along and says, okay, there are several people on this space cruiser, and the genders are not important. We'll assign them when we do the casting. And that's exactly how Alien was cast. It was, you know, supposedly anyway, cast to be gender neutral. Any of the characters could have been played by either gender. So
I think so much of New Hollywood is rooted in that, this idea of masculinity, you know, tough guys. And it just, to John's point, it gets, you know, it gets kind of exhausting if you watch these, you know, enough of these pictures. One of the ones that Richard and I talked about is Five Easy Pieces. You know, Jack Nicholson's this frustrated piano player, and there's this famous scene in the diner where the waitress, the older waitress comes over, and he wants to make a special order, and she says, "No, we can't do that," and he totally goes up on her, and is just a total asshole. And everybody ate it up; the audience ate it up, but it exposes, I think, that the counterculture had no relationship with the working class. They didn't really understand the working class. If they did, you know, Jack Nicholson would have understood why this waitress was telling him he couldn't have exactly what he wanted to have, right?
Yeah.
But he's so spoiled and so privileged that he doesn't understand why he can't have exactly what he wants. So just this underlying disconnection from the working class. It, not just generation, you know, generationally, sure, but also, you know, there was a large number of young people who were part of the working class who were not hippies or part of the counterculture. You know, the counterculture was a minority in America. They just got, you know, a disproportionate amount of press.
And yeah, my mom and dad were growing up in the 60s. I was born in 1972. And,
same with me.
You know, my mum and dad, I remember my dad going, I never thought the Beatles could sing. You know, they listened to to sort of show tunes the whole time throughout the 60s.
My parents met in a record store. They were working in a record store. They didn't have, you know, they didn't have time. They needed to work and make money. And so that was the reality, I think, in America, at least, is that it was this minority. And I, you know, I don't want to say they, you know, I don't hate the counterculture. They gave us so much that, you know, art and ideas that we, you know, we're still, working off of today. But I just think that was part of, when you talk about sort of New Hollywood and sort of film during this time, I don't think you can talk about it without recognizing the influence of the counterculture and sort of how the counterculture was perceived in the country at large.
But wasn't the counterculture to some degree, or isn't it the way we view it today? Haven't we sort of depoliticized it in the sense that I always think it's really interesting how, for instance, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but many, many views of Manson concentrate on he was a hippie, he hung around with the Beach Boys, he was you know, into drug use and using drugs as a way, all of which were true. But, you know, the core of his ideology was racism. But you never, you know, if you had a sort of family fortunes, you know, Charles Manson, how many words, you know, what was the first word that we asked the studio audience, and the first word they said was hippie, the second word was murderer, the third word was Beach Boys. Nobody would say racist, but racism was absolutely central to his whole ideology. It's a white supremacist. But again, nobody would ever say Charles Manson, the white supremacist. But, you know, if he'd been, you know, reading Mao, you would definitely have that on line one of every newspaper. You know, Maoist Charlie Manson sent a bunch of. So you sort of depoliticize someone because they're right wing. You know.
Yeah, and I think also you can't forget that he was almost a full generation older than the members of the family. Like, you know, grew up in institutions, like whether it was orphanages, you know, juvenile hall, like, you know, this guy is a hardened con. He comes out at the age of like 33 or something like that in The Summer of Love, and he's like, oh my god, there are all these people I can grift and rook and basically draw into my web. And, you know, again, like he's doing it from the perspective of someone with a lot of life experience on the inside, you know, and, you know, that when you're a 19-year-old librarian going to college in Berkeley or whatever, like, you know, that's as vast a difference culturally as you can imagine. And, you know, I mention it in the book, but like many, many people think that people like Manson who headed cults of personality were just doing the work of destroying the counterculture actively at the hands of COINTELPRO, the FBI, whatever. The links are there, you know, they're you have to tease them out. And, you know, O'Brien does very well in his book Chaos to do
yeah,
so.
Yeah, it's an like, excellent book. Really good read.
It really is. But like, you know, the fact is that like, you know, there's a reason why the media latched onto, hey, the counterculture is over now because this guy murdered a film star and her friends.
Well, they used him to demonize the entire exactly. you know, anti-war movement, which, mm-hmm. you know, and if the anti-war movement ended Vietnam one day earlier, then the anti-war movement did the right thing, you know? So I don't want to, again, I'm not, I don't, I don't politically disagree with the counterculture. I just think a lot of that attitude and a lot of the things that they did were naive. Of course, they were young. But their reaction against Vietnam was absolutely the right reaction. And for sort of, you know, what John said before, the silent majority to sort of blame them instead of blaming Nixon is morally, you know, reprehensible. So I just want to get my pro counterculture part out there into the open. Where they were coming from was absolutely the right direction. I mean, they knew what was going on in the war.
Yeah.
I want to move finally onto to the 80s and Richard, this was you, this was the chapter that you the section that you dominated.
I don't know about dominated.
Well, there's four chapters and you write three of them. So is that because you're what was the reason for that distribution?
I think it was mainly it was sort of practicalities in a sense. Like Kelly said before, we originally had a much larger set of chapters planned. I had a lot. I had several for the 70s section and things. I was look at. Oh God, I can't remember. There were some pretty ridiculous ones, but just because of the way things ended up going, it just seemed more. We kind of concentrated on ones that seemed solid. And we're already quite a way on. So I think it was basically just chance more than anything else. Not because I'm in any way more of an expert than these two guys. These two guys are very, very expert.
And so you start the section with Poltergeist and slamming it up against Suburbia. And this is the, Kelly mentioned earlier that you were getting quite angry about this one.
Yeah, I mean, the Poltergeist was another. It produced a very well. No, I mean, because I still have a lot of affection for Silent Running. I don't have any affection for Poltergeist. I hated it. It's a film that I was convinced I'd seen, and then when I watched it, maybe I hadn't ever seen it. Maybe I just lied to myself because when I was, you know, it came out as a kid, and I hadn't been able to see it. I just kind of, you know, you kind of dream these things into your brain.
I bet you read the novelization.
Exactly.
That novelization was ubiquitous. I think I read that. I don't think I saw it until I got it on DVD.
That's a lot of my film history is that I read novelizations like mad. And then I just basically brainwashed myself into thinking I'd seen the film. I was like, I've seen it. I mean, I basically lied to myself for years about having seen it. I just lied. I read the book and just told myself I'd seen it. So, Poltergeist just really got on my nerves. I just couldn't stand it. And it really, I don't know, everything about it just seemed so fraudulent and just sickening to me. I really had this is probably a bit of a theme, isn't it? That I have a ridiculously over-the-top reaction to things. But
I think you're just mad because it was supposed to be a Tobe Hooper film and we all love Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I mean, there is that. There is that. But there's also, there's just something just fraudulent about it. It feels like an act of fraud being perpetrated on the audience. It's a lie, you know, in the sense, you know, normally I don't give a shit if it's enjoyable, you know, who cares, but it just seemed like it was so blatant and so in your face and like, yeah, Texas Chainsaw, that stuff's over. There's none of that now. It's just this, you know, just like sitting in some shitty restaurant. And
it just... Chainsaw Massacre is about counterculture, and then Poltergeist is about boomers, right? I mean, you talk a lot about sort of the parents and how they act, and how, you know, that's kind of a follow through, right? I mean, this is what the hippies became.
Well, I think that's the thing, isn't it? It sort of like gives the lies for a lot of what had come before, and it kind of shows this, and it presents it as something that's sort of admirable. I think that's the thing. It's not presenting it with any kind of skepticism. It's like, this is it. This is great. These poor people are being, you know, that's the thing that really annoyed me, which is silly, I suppose, is the way that it doesn't look in any way at how shit their parenting is. Mm. You know, their kids get attacked by a fucking demon. And then the next thing, he's off to work. Yeah, the kids are off in the bed, same bedroom that they were attacked by a demon, which is silly, but it also is quite telling that that's not, you know, even for the people writing it, that's not an issue. You'll just stick your kids back in the same bedroom. Yeah, they just got nearly killed by a demon. Yeah, they'll go back.
I think the reason why I feel so fraudulent is because it uses the trappings of Gothic horror, but has none of the, because the suburbs are so dissociated from history, you have to throw this sort of like afterthought in the end. Oh, you didn't move the bodies, but like, who cares? Like, you know, like it's a suburb, right? Like it's supposed to look like any number of other suburbs out there in the American, you know, landscape. And you don't feel like the Gothic horror is earned at all. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. It just wants you to give it the money, and it doesn't want to earn what it's asking for. And I just, I think that seems that you've nailed it, Mike. That's the thing. It basically is a fraud. It's like a sort of Ponzi scheme of horror type thing. And I just,
It struck me on watching it after all those years of thinking I'd watched it like you, Richard, that I really detected the fingers, the very long, strong fingers of Spielberg all over it. And I love Spielberg. Yeah. I'm a big fan of Spielberg, but it's almost like there are some genres which are really resistant to him. He can sprinkle horror in his family entertainments, but when it came to him doing an all-out horror, he couldn't get rid of his family. You know what I mean? I think he works very well as a subversive filmmaker, Spielberg. Like Close Encounters of the Third Kind is all about the destruction of the nuclear family by a man.
Close Encounters is also a much more frightening film than Poltergeist. E.T. is more frightening than Poltergeist.
True.
You know,
true.
Duel is more frightening. Jaws is more like Poltergeist is the least frightening thing in many ways. You had anything to do with it? It's like, what is his problem?
No, that's a really good point, actually. So I've just said he hasn't done horror, and you've just given me four examples. I mean, you're right. Jaws and Duel are pure horror films. They're not, there's no like sprinkling of horror elements into a Raiders of the Lost Ark, say, which you could argue is less, not really a horror movie, but yeah. But that's so fascinating. What about moving forward into sort of the 90s and the present day? I mean, God, we've had 20 years since the 90s, 23 years since the end of the 90s. I know. So is there going to be a volume two where We Are the Mutants is going to take on from the 90s on? Because I'd love to see you pair Fight Club with something, or... Gosh. No Country for Old Men, or, you know.
Fellas, I'm afraid I'm going to have to let Kelly and Mike answer this, because unfortunately, I'm sorry, this is so rude, but I have to go. So,
no worries.
Kelly
Richard.
And Mike are way more equipped than me to answer this question anyway.
Okay.
John, it's been a pleasure. Thank you ever so much, man. It's been great, really. Thank you. And thanks for your comments. Great.
Take care, Richard.
Bye-bye.
I'm not sure I'm equipped to do the 90s. I feel like the 90s, I don't know. We've been working sort of this Cold War background for so long. We put so much sort of research into it. I mean, if we did the 90s, and also I don't think I'm as interested in 90s films as I am in sort of the 60s through the 80s. Mike, I don't know if you feel the same way here.
I think one of the reasons why when we put together We Are the Mutants, the site, like, we wanted to concentrate on things that we kind of remembered, right? So like from early, you know, childhood to adolescence. And I think that you saw it in these last, you know, this last hour or so, talking to us and like we didn't really remember all these films quite the same way. See, the thing is, anything I saw after high school, say in the mid 90s, I can recall with pretty instantaneous, like, you know, recall where I saw it, when I saw it, the circumstances. I was an adult watching movies. But, you know, even, you know, the ones that I didn't understand, the ones that I watched on, you know, UHF TV, where they would show them unedited, and it was a big deal because you, before the VCR, you really couldn't see unedited films on television. All those movies I watched way, way too young, like The Deer Hunter, Apocalypse Now, you know, that showed up on these television channels. Like, the reason why we wanted to focus on those kind of movies in this book is because we knew that we were going to see something new in all of them. And I just feel like past, again, kind of like early 90s, I may occasionally see something new, but the distance, that the historical distance between now and the movies that we covered in this book, I think generated so much of the interest in our heads. It's sort of like the world was very different in 1973 than it is in 2023. And that makes it kind of interesting to go back. I could talk your ear off about the last 25, 30 years of cinema, but it wouldn't, it's because history kind of stopped, didn't it? It's because we're kind of in that post, you know, end of history kind of, you know, endless regurgitation of stuff. Like it would be hard to look at a lot of cinema from the last 30 years and not just see the cynical impulses behind it, which is not to say there's not been lots of great art movies or lots of great independent movies. There have been, but I just feel like the blockbusters would be a tougher road to hoe with the blockbusters of the 90s and beyond.
I'd be interested to hear what John thinks, but I just think it's because films have become increasingly more self-conscious. Maybe that's not the right, but I just feel like it was possible.
Self-aware, for sure. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, I feel like it was possible to make a movie about a killer alligator in 1982 and be totally serious about it, totally serious about it in a way that wouldn't happen in the following decades, right? Like Sharknado, when everything's got to be a parody of a parody of a parody, and their Easter eggs.
Lake Placid was good.
I like Lake Placid.
I mean, you're right. Yeah, there's an element of irony there, but it isn't.
Yeah.
It isn't Sharknado. It isn't silly. I mean, it's ironic, but it's not silly. I'm going to push back a tiny bit here, if not a lot, because I think that I agree. You know, we're close to it to some degree. It's difficult to look at it from a historical perspective. Haven't quite got that distance, but as we go back, I think, you know, time has a way of concertinaing, and so you know, Fight Club is closer to Rosemary's Babies than we are to Fight Club. That's not quite true. Probably. I don't know. I haven't quite done the maths.
It's close. It's very close.
We're getting to the point where Charles Manson and The Doors is closer to their subject matter than we are to The Doors, perhaps. That might be a better example. My point is, If I look at the big blockbusters of the 90s, I actually see something which, again, we watched quite naively, but the political repercussions we're living with today. I mean, what do we talk about in terms of, we talk about Snowflakes, Fight Club. We talk about being red-pilled, The Matrix. The Phantom Menace comes back in 1999, and we're looking at a Disney-fied version of what was a counterculture. I'm it's only because I want to persuade you to write this book. It's because I want to read it.
I will leave you with this one thing, which is that there's this great bit in the middle of Adam Curtis's Hypernormalization, where he puts together all of the disaster film and alien invasion film footage from like the early 90s to right before 9/11. And we just see how similar that set of spectacles is to the day that the airplanes hit the towers. And I don't think, that says it all right there, right? You know, sort of this idea of spectacle being regurgitated over and over again and eventually leaking into the real world. It's super interesting, but I do feel like it's been definitely stated once or twice already. And I think that, you know, it's funny that you bring up Tarantino, this whole conversation, because I did get the book for Christmas as well. I think we all did. And, you know, it's so funny. I've really cooled on him as a director. Once Upon a Time, I thought was great. Before that, the two or three films before that, I wasn't crazy about. But I will tell you something. He writes about film incredibly engagingly. And I think that he too, also as somebody who came out of this 90s kind of, you know, period where film became kind of self-referential, more sort of aware of its own history. Like, if anything, he has an incredible knowledge of film history, and he brings that to bear nakedly in everything he does. I mean, there are blatant references throughout, as Kelly said, quote unquote, Easter eggs throughout all of his films. But I think as he's gotten older, he's gotten like to feel like, well, you know what? I want to play with that history a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So let's make it so, you know, Manson family do get killed when they go into the house. Let's make it so, you know, World War II ends, you know, 5 months early or whatever. Like he's more interested now in playing with the history than actually just like spitting it out back on the screen. And so I think that's probably the meta modernist rather than postmodernist sort of impulse, is to kind of play with the history and see how much you can get away with.
It's fascinating. When you were talking about Manson earlier, I stopped myself because I thought I'd mentioned Tarantino a couple too many times. But it is that idea that, ironically, Manson in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood should have been closer to one of the Reservoir Dog characters than the sort of, you know, the hippie-fied distant. Maybe that's why you don't have him in the movie, because if he got close to the movie, you'd go, wait a minute, he's the same age as Rick Dalton.
Yeah, that's really good. That's really, really good.
You know, what bothered me about Once Upon a Time was I expected the Brad Pitt character to go back to the ranch and decimate everyone, including Manson. And I felt a little let down that Manson sort of got off, didn't he? I've only seen the movie one time.
It wasn't like Inglourious Basterds where they get to actually show you in great detail Hitler getting machine gunned and burned down in the theater.
I feel if you're trying to sort of get Manson, like, go get him. I don't know. That's just, I sort of thought.
You could have even had that as a post-credit sting.
Yeah.
He goes and hunts them down after he gets out of the hospital, right? But I mean, that's the thing, history. Right? The Spahn Ranch set piece is meant to be like the gunfight before the gunfight in the Western. Mm-hmm. Right? It's meant to be like the one where you get a little hint of what's going to happen in the finale, but not quite. He just beats up Clem and, you know, like makes him change his tire. But like
he beats up Elvis Presley. It's not Elvis Presley, is it? Because Elvis Presley turns up on the horse afterwards. That's
it's Bruce Lee, which is a...
Yeah, well, there you go, right? I mean, that's the other thing. I want to put my fictional character up against this real person. And it's, you know, Tarantino, he's one of those people who I want to hate, but I end up coming back to his stuff and always kind of just getting, I get something out of it. And I think it's because we came out of that same television fed sort of like cineast idea where, you know, like we consumed so much film and so much television before the age of 13 or whatever, that it's all just kind of burned into our brains, you know. And it's made him a very deft observer of cinema. Whether he's a real critic or not, I can't really tell. That book is still, I still am not quite sure how I feel about that book, but he's definitely plowed his own sort of area of interest at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, guys, I got one last question for you. Recommended books. Could you recommend a film book for our listeners?
Mike, you go first.
All right, I'm gonna go off script because it's a book that was foundational to the making of this book.
Sure.
I just want to mention it here. It's not all about film. There's some film in it. Andreas Killen's 1933 Nervous Breakdown, Watergate, Warhol, and the Birth of Post-60s America. Please check it out. It's a great time capsule of, I think, what is the most crucial year in the entire 1970s.
Brilliant.
It's a brilliant book, yeah. I mean, if I had to do one book, it would be Jay Hoberman, The Dream Life, Movies, Media, The Mythology of the 60s, where he actually starts in the late 50s and goes all the way up through Dirty Harry. And
you sound like Peter Fonda in The Limey. The 60s started in the 50s and went
exactly.
But I think it's definitely a foundational text in my mind in terms of sort of analyzing film with sort of history and sociological impact sort of interweaving with each film. It's really, really a brilliant book. All his books are amazing, but this one in particular, I think, is a must read if you're interested in film and film history.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are great recommendations. I've penciled them in. I'll write them on the show notes. And of course, we can read more of your stuff. I'll put a link to the book in the show notes as well, but also a link to your website where you you study more than film, and you go really into depth in a way which I think is incredibly accessible and entertaining. And I loved reading your book. I gave it to Jonah Nazzaro, who is the head of the Locarno Film Festival, and he's a fellow genre fan, and he
thank you,
and he ate it up. He loved it. So
thanks so much, John.
Very nice to hear.
Yeah, no, there's it's a book I would absolutely. I think anybody who's listening to this podcast will love this book, and I can guarantee that. So hopefully you'll all go and buy it. So thanks so much, Michael and Kelly. And thanks also to Richard, who had to leave early, but brilliant contributions all.
Yeah. Thank you so much, John, for having us.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
So that was my conversation with Richard, Kelly and Michael. I hope you enjoyed it. I personally thought it was amazing. I really could have talked for another hour. I hope the guys will agree to come back and talk about some other things, because I think there's plenty of stuff that we could mine. I'd love to get their takes on other stuff as well. Their recommended books were Andrew Killen's 1973 Nervous Breakdown, Watergate, Warhol, and the Birth of Post-60s America, and Jay Hoberman's The Dream Life, Movies, Media, and the Mythology of the 60s. And you can find both those recommendations in the show notes, along with links to the book and links to the We Are the Mutants website. Okay, thank you. Oh, next week I'm off to another film festival in Norway this time, the Tromsø Film Festival. So I might be doing I might manage to record something while I'm out there and put that up. Otherwise, there will be a gap of a week before the next episode. That's it, really. Thanks very much for listening. Thank you very much to Elliot Atkins for the music, and thanks to Ali Harwood for the artwork, and thanks to you, dear listener, for your support, your continued support and audience. Take care.